You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Did you know that some of our break music comes from independent musicians? Maybe you'll be one of them. Find more information at thetakeaway.org/music.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There was this great moment in the movie Gravity. I don't know if you remember it. It's been haunting me in this current crisis in Ukraine. It was right at the beginning of that space movie, before things got really ugly. There was this out-of-the-blue message from Mission Control.
NORAD reports a Russian satellite has incurred a missile strike. The impact has created a cloud of debris orbiting at 20,000 miles per hour. Current debris orbit does not overlap with your trajectory. We'll keep you posted on any developments.
Copy that, Houston. Should we be worried?
Well, let's let the boys down there worry for us.
Russia shoots its own satellite in the movies. It was something to worry about. Of course, it produced a chain reaction and a very wide disaster for a nice Hollywood story. But how about down on planet Earth? Could Crimea and the Ukraine crisis produce some kind of 21st century chain reaction? We'll talk about that later this hour. Also, a look at the human experience of aging. We'll talk to genomic and synthetic life scientist J. Craig Venter about his new venture that aims to use genomics to comprehensively slow aging. We'll be exploring the impact of longer life expectancy all this week. You would make different plans about your life if you thought you'd be around for 150 years, right? Tell us your story of all of this. We'll also look at how social planning might be affected by folks living up to two centuries. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But we begin with the mystery that has captured the world's attention, the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, a plane carrying 239 people, a Boeing 777, on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, simply gone, vanished.
From the day the aircraft lost contact and disappeared from our radar, there's no signal being able to be detected.
That's Director General of the Malaysian Department of Civil Aviation, Azharuddin Abdulrahman, in a news conference yesterday. Barbara Peterson is aviation correspondent, longtime aviation correspondent, and a contributor to Condé Nast Traveler and a friend of this program. Welcome to The Takeaway, Barbara.
It's good to be here.
How does a plane simply disappear like this?
Well, it does seem really preposterous, I know, in this day and age. When you assume that, you know, satellites are watching every move and every plane ought to be tracked 24/7, but it is actually possible. Now, what we know is that around, 40 minutes into the flight, it, quote, disappeared from radar. Now, that doesn't mean really much, because that just means that the signal was lost. Every aircraft has a transponder that constantly transmits the location and the altitude and the speed. But what can happen is if it's away from a radar station and something goes wrong, and we clearly know something, but not much more than that, it can drop off the tracking system. Now, it's continuing still until something terrible happens to totally destroy the aircraft to transmit that. But it
all the way down. I mean, it was at 33,000 feet. All the way down, it must have transmitted something somewhere.
Yes, and that's why we are also hearing some other reports that maybe military radar may have picked up something after civilian air traffic control lost contact.
And a loss at sea is often unrecoverable except in shallow areas, because if you get into the deep parts of the Pacific and the Atlantic, there's no possible way of even examining the wreckage.
Well, it has happened that aircraft have been recovered from incredible depths. And the one that I'm thinking of is the closest, or could be the closest in this case, is Air France 447, which is in 2009.
And lost that in the North Atlantic.
Yes, it was in the middle of the ocean, literally. And it ended up being recovered from an enormous depth of 13,000 feet. And that took several major, very costly expeditions, deep sea effect dive to find it. And the key to all of this, though, are what they refer to as the black boxes.
Which people have been describing as relatively low-tech for our age, in that they rely on sonar and that their ability to penetrate water is very, very limited.
Precisely. And if, you know, as you point out, it's 1960s technology, effectively, that we're relying on here. Now, there was a reason why we had that, because they were built to be indestructible. And by the way, they're neither black nor really a box.
Right,
but
but
they contain both the voice recorder, which records, you know, the cockpit conversations up until the moment, you know, when it stops. And they also record a lot of vital information about the plane. Now, the point was to make them so indestructible they could, you know, survive being at the bottom of the ocean for years and fire and whatnot. However, the point is that we need the information sooner than that. And there are the means to get it, really stream it constantly during the flight.
So there are means to actually stream all of the content from the cockpit, from even the sound in the interior of the aircraft, offline to the cloud and have it recoverable almost immediately, but we just don't do that. We haven't upgraded.
Yes, exactly.
And what would that require to get all of aviation to adopt a standard like that?
Well, that is the issue, because every time there is an accident like this, and of course there aren't that many, and that's part of the problem in
right.
a sense. They're so rare, they're so few that immediately after an accident, as in the case of Air France, there's a great hue and cry for why aren't we doing this? And regulators say they're going to do it, and the industry sort of, you know, says I will go along. And then the impetus goes away. And it would be costly. Let's, you know, let's be honest about that. It would be costly.
No, retrofitting tens of thousands of aircraft.
Yes, and it would require an additional satellite and additional bandwidth. But there are ways to do it where it could capture some, if not all, of the vital information, at least more than what we have.
A discussion that's certainly very relevant to that Malaysian aircraft, but not much consolation for the victims, the family members who must simply wait from the disappearance of Flight 370. Barbara Peterson, longtime aviation correspondent, contributor to Condé Nast Traveler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To Ukraine crisis, where the players have paused with Crimea poised to try and rejoin Russia. Russia apparently not standing in the way of that. And the West, especially the United States, threatening sanctions and accusing the parties of violating international law. The question, is Crimea the first building block in Vladimir Putin's recreation of a Soviet Union?
I don't think that he wants to recreate the Soviet Union precisely because he doesn't want to have responsibility for economic basket cases like Ukraine is at the present time.
Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking on Fox News Sunday. Over the weekend, the notion of de facto annexation by Russia of Crimea emerged from both Russia and that territory. But so is economic turmoil. Market sell-offs are probably the biggest sanction out there, constraining Vladimir Putin from actually doing something to restart the Cold War. Last week, the Russian stock market index fell by more than 12%, wiping out $60 billion in value. Interest rates rose to 7% from 5.5% in an effort to stabilize the ruble. James Stewart, columnist for our partner, The New York Times, says that economically there is no going back to the Cold War and that a sudden $60 billion loss may have delivered a message to Vladimir Putin.
Well, it's fascinating that it does seem to be having some effect on his actions. At least people I talked to said that he's been very aware of both the stock market and the currency market reactions. And yes, there are speculators crawling all over this. And that's part of why he has to pay attention, that these people, they're like voting with their money. And that's an incredibly important part of the Russian economy today, the foreign capital, foreign investment, which, of course, was not true all during the Cold War.
There are other bets that are going on, though, in the Russian stock market, and there are other sort of bigger bets in stock markets that follow and track and have exchange-traded funds that, you know, track emerging markets. And that is whether the West has the capacity to do anything really to confront an annexation of Crimea. And if the betting starts going against the West, Putin could really benefit here in the exact same way that he's taken such a $60 billion hit in the early going.
Well, that's possible, but at least people I talked to thought that's very unlikely, primarily because there's nothing good about sanctions which are being threatened by the West, and they're not especially good for the West either. When it comes to the economics, the West has a lot more leverage than Russia does, partly because the economies are so much bigger and more diversified There might be some short-term disruptions in the oil, natural gas situation, but I don't really see much upside, at least from an economic perspective, to Putin in this maneuver. But the Cold War really ended not because of military actions, but because of economic pressures and the isolation of the old Soviet Union. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia's whole strategy has been to integrate into the global economy. Now that's all under threat.
Is it possible for the West to find an alternative for Russian gas and for the broader energy economy to isolate Russia as one of the largest producers of petroleum?
People think so. I mean, it wouldn't happen overnight. It might be some expenses involved. But natural gas is an amazingly plentiful supply today, primarily because of the shale production in North America. And it's just a matter of finding a way of getting it over there. And those technologies are under active development now. But even places like Norway, even Europe itself has a lot of resources, at least to get through a year or so, because you know, the timing of this isn't great for Russia since it is spring and the demand for natural gas is going to naturally seasonally go down.
So in many ways, this scenario is tailor-made for economic sanctions, which have been so frustrating and haven't really worked terribly well in the past.
That's absolutely right. And I think part of the reason that the sanctions are such a threat is that, like, say, even unlike in Iran, Russia is much more now tethered to the global economy as a result of the policies they've put in place over the last few decades. Most of the financing for Russian companies comes from the West. It was fascinating to me to look at the Gazprom, for example, the biggest market capitalization company on the Russian stock market. It's half owned by the Russian government. But if you look at the individual shareholders, the largest number of them are Americans. And I was surprised to see that one of the largest, not surprisingly, is Vanguard, you know, the big mutual fund index fund. There are plenty of Americans probably who don't even realize that they own shares in Gazprom through their mutual funds and index funds. That really means that Russia depends very heavily on Western participation in its economic growth.
Although some would say Vanguard's participation might constrain the West, you say it's actually a weapon that Vanguard can use to be a part of this kind of a front line against Putin with these financial weapons.
Well, I suppose Russia could nationalize again these companies that are publicly traded, and you know that would certainly send a shock through. But that would set the Russian economy back 50 years. You know, that just is inconceivable to most people.
You know, finally, in the New York Times, there have been comparisons to not so much the Cold War, but the appeasement of Adolf Hitler during World War II, talks of Czechoslovakia's situation, the Sudetenland that was annexed by Germany prior to the invasion of Poland, which touched off World War II. You know, Adolf Hitler financed his insanity and his aggression with a lot of, you know, hyperinflated paper within Germany. I mean, he didn't particularly have finances at the center of his notion of what the heck he was doing. Does ideology trump economics in situations like this? And is that a sort of dangerous dark card that we don't really know the outcome of there?
Well, I think, yes, ideology can trump it. I think the comparisons to Germany, Nazi Germany, are a little superficial, really. So many things have changed. But yes, ideology can always trump reason, and we've seen it throughout history. But one of the curious things about this today is there's not really any ideology at play here. Putin is not a communist. He may be an empire builder. He may want to be trying to create a sphere of influence. And Russia may be a form of sort of crony capitalism, but it is capitalism today. Nobody is talking about a return to Marxism-Leninism. And that, again, I think is why that Russia is vulnerable to pressures from the West and why ultimately I would think reason would prevail, because it's not really an ideological contest.
James Stewart, columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A year after being confirmed by Congress as CIA director, John Brennan seems to be in a world of hurt.
As far as the allegations of, you know, CIA hacking into, you know, Senate computers, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we wouldn't do that. I mean, that's just beyond the scope of reason.
CIA Director Brennan has suddenly earned himself the wrath of steadfast CIA supporter, senior Democrat, and chair of the powerful Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, over that allegation he is denying there in an appearance before the Council on Foreign Relations. But he did quietly offer his head over the matter.
If there was any inappropriate actions that were taken related to that review, either by CIA or by the SSCI staff, I'll be the first one to say we need to get to the bottom of it. And if I did something wrong, I will go to the president and I will explain to him exactly what I did and what the findings were. And he is the one who can ask me to stay or to go.
Senator Feinstein might say Brennan should go if she was making the decision today. She believes the CIA did spy on her committee's computers. And further, she believes that the issue of CIA surveillance of congressional computers is a constitutional one.
On January 17th, I wrote a letter to Director Brennan objecting to any further CIA investigation due to the separation of powers constitutional issues that the search raised. I followed this with a second letter on January 23rd to the director, asking 12 specific questions about the CIA's actions, questions that the CIA has refused to answer.
That's Senator Dianne Feinstein. Todd Zwillich, takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So, Todd, Senator Feinstein can be angry about all this, and you can certainly hear it there. The CIA may have done something illegal here, and that wouldn't be the first time. But separation of powers? I mean, doesn't the FBI investigate members of Congress from time to time? Is that always a constitutional question?
It often can be. And in fact, members of Congress have some constitutional immunities from that kind of investigation because of separation of powers. Now, keep in mind, of course, this isn't the FBI. This is the CIA. And the CIA is specifically prevented in the law from spying on any Americans, much less members of Congress, and much less when there's an investigation underway in the Senate Intelligence Committee's oversight role. This all goes back a few years, John. What the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing is investigating the detention, rendition, and interrogation programs that went back to the post-9/11 era in the CIA under the Bush administration. Now, that program, of course, was ended officially 5 years ago when President Obama, new to his presidency, shut it down. But the CIA says it was ended even before then, after public scrutiny of the detention interrogation programs around the war on terror. Now, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, however, is still investigating that. They're working on a report that's over 6,000 pages long already. And here's what this is about. Senate staffers were at an off-site location, a classified location, and given access to CIA files. This is how they do their oversight investigations, and this is quite normal. But there's a dispute between the Senate committee and the CIA about what those staffers should be allowed to read, when they read it, and also a dispute over a previous CIA report, a Leon Panetta report called the Panetta Review, on this exact same topic. So what allegedly happened and what Senator Dianne Feinstein directly accused the CIA of doing when she was on the Senate floor this morning, John, was searching those computers, the Senate staff computers, hacking into them.
And let's just be precise. These Senate staff computers are actually given to the Senate staff by the CIA to have access to classified documents. So they're both from the CIA but are supposed to be independent.
That's exactly right. They're both those things. They're from the CIA, but they're under the purview of the Senate, of the legislative branch, if you will. Dianne Feinstein accusing the Senate of searching and hacking those computers to find out exactly what the Senate staffers were taking, and that's why she says it's a separation of powers issue. Then ever since then, John, there was a counter-accusation. When, after the Senate Intelligence Committee's accusation, John, there was a referral to the Justice Department. Senator Feinstein saying there that she thinks several laws may have been broken, including the one I mentioned. The CIA is not allowed to spy on Americans, and there are other executive orders that may have violated as well, in her opinion. After that, John, a retaliation from the Inspector General of the CIA, who reportedly filed a criminal complaint with the Department of Justice as well, saying that Senate staffers themselves may have been inappropriately looking at documents. Dianne Feinstein says that's balderdash. They're just retaliating and trying to go tit for tat, forcing the Justice Department to adjudicate this increasingly bloody battle between the Senate Intelligence Committee and the CIA that it oversees.
Which is why the framers probably came up with the doctrine of separation of powers, to prevent this kind of tit for tat sort of bloody battling that we see being played out. I'm wondering, let me give you a conspiracy theory here. Do you think it's possible that Dianne Feinstein is looking for some cover here? She has been steadfastly in support of the administration during all of the Snowden and the WikiLeaks period. She's been very much pro-surveillance, backing the CIA. Does she want cover here? Is she trying to back away?
John, I like the way you think, but of course I can't speculate on whether or not she's looking for cover there. Look, Senator Feinstein is chairman of the Intelligence Committee, has a choice every time she's asked whether she should be supporting NSA surveillance or CIA rendition or other factors in the war on terror. She has a choice. She's not forced into it. It would be pretty amazing for her to accuse the Central Intelligence Agency of constitutional and criminal wrongdoing against her staff unless she had a very good reason to do so.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You bet.
Science legend Craig Venter would love to live more than 100 years.
People have a chance to be productive longer, which is good for them and good for society. Retirement generally isn't good for anybody.
Venter wants to use genomics technology he pioneered to take on aging. He'll talk about that later in the program. What's a lifelong friend when you're 150 years old? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to the facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Our Paralympics profile today is a Nordic skier with a vision impairment competing for the U.S. in Sochi. Team USA is still looking for its first gold medal of these very competitive games. Kevin Burton was an Arabic linguist in the United States Navy when he was diagnosed with a degenerative eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa. He's an example of how the Paralympics bring people from very different backgrounds together. Kevin was never interested in winter sports until he did his rehab at a center in Georgia. He loved the combination of the intense exertion of cross-country skiing and the patience required to shoot, especially when you're blind.
It's pretty similar for visually impaired skiers to cross-country ski. The only difference from able-bodied people is that we ski with a guide in front of us all the time that we follow and they keep us safe. The shooting is, it's pretty hard to stop when your heart's racing and everything and be really precise with the rifle. The visually impaired rifle, you aim by sound, which adds another layer of difficulty to the sport.
So there's some sort of sonar indicator of whether you're close to the target before you pull the trigger?
Yeah, it uses an infrared targeting system. When you first pick up the rifle, it's a steady beeping noise. And as you get closer to the center of the target, the beeping noise gets faster and then it turns into a steady tone. As you get closer and closer, the tone gets higher pitched.
So let's talk about your guide for a moment. How does your guide keep you safe out there on the snow?
My guide and I, we use an intercom system that was actually designed for motorcycles. Some people, their guides just turn and yell to them. It works for people who have a little bit of vision, but you don't get to pass as much information. And then a totally blind skier, their guide would wear a speaker on their back and constantly make noise for the athlete to follow them. I mean, it does take trust. If you don't trust your guide, you probably wouldn't be able to go all out on downhills and stuff.
Does your guide have to be a better, faster cross-country skier than you to make this work, or are you about equal?
My guides are all better skiers than I am. There's a Canadian that's the top of our division. He actually qualified for the Vancouver Olympics, not just Paralympics. His guides, one of them competed in Sochi in the Olympics, but he's just as fast as his guides. So they'll take breaks or switch off while they're skiing with him because he's so fast, it's hard to keep up.
Has any guide ever kind of ruined it for anyone at the Paralympics by wiping out or leading you wrong?
I'm sure it's happened. I haven't encountered that on my own. I've heard stories from Vancouver before I was into the sport where during the sprint races, the competitors skied in front of their guides to try to sprint to the finish, and the guides had to yell stuff from behind the competitors.
So have you always been a skier, Kevin?
No, I didn't pick up skiing until 2011 when I was going through blind rehabilitation through the VA. And when I went to the training camp, I wasn't really sure what to expect. But when I, at the end of it, I met with the coaches and they asked me if it would be something I'd be willing to train full time and with hopes to make it to Sochi. And being only my second year of skiing, my chances for a medal aren't that great, but I'm skiing better than I ever have. So hopefully, especially with biathlon, if I have a good day shooting and skiing, anything can happen.
You know what I love about the Paralympics is that in the regular Olympics, you know, people have been training for years and years and years and years, and this is their whole life. And for so many Paralympians, it's, started a year ago or started 2 years ago or got into it, you know, right after my accident kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's a whole different story.
Oh, yeah. It's the majority of the team, they weren't skiers previous to their injuries or anything. It's something that they got recruited from another sport or they just went to try it out at a camp or something. And they work just as hard as the Olympians and they're amazing athletes. But yeah, most of them are fairly new to the sport.
Kevin, I want to wish you the best of luck in Sochi.
All right. Thank you.
Kevin Burton is the USA Paralympics Nordic skier, cross country and biathlon. Edward Snowden was the on-screen headliner at the South by Southwest Festival yesterday in Austin, Texas. Warning of terrorism, he gave a kind of having the time of my life in Russia speech to the South by crew. That was just one of the bigger non-musical moments of this festival that has moved away from music and is all zeitgeist these days. The music is still there, though, about 2,000 bands, and Matt Riley, program director at KUTX, is finding some interesting ones when he can find a parking space in South by Overrun, Austin.
There's bands, obviously, from all over the world. Over 2,000 descend on Austin for this four-day music extravaganza. And there's one from Mali, from northern Mali, called Tanarawin. And these guys are nomads. They're Tuaregs. And they wear their full outfits on stage. And they mix northern African music with blues and rock. And it's an amazing sound.
And is the world music ethos, something that's gone back to the beginning of South by Southwest, or is that relatively recent musical addition to the festival?
No, it's always been a part of South by Southwest. In fact, over the years, there's been Japan Night, and you have all these great, crazy bands from Japan playing all over Austin, and they usually dedicate one whole night to Japan Night. But you've got acts from Europe and Africa and Asia, and it's really a lot of fun. It really is a melting pot.
Lucius, I'm gathering, is not a Japan act.
No, Lucius is from Brooklyn. They're a duo, Jess Wolf and Holly Lasig, and they met at Berklee College of Music. Kind of quirky. They dress the same. Their hair is cut the same. But a really fun live act and infectious music. And keep your eye on Lucius. I think they're going to have a big 2014.
And finally, no one would ever accuse public radio of being top 40, right, in its musical playlists and selections. But what do you think of this idea of, you know, characterizing an artist or a set of artists or maybe even just a tune as the state's music, the state's tune? There are various algorithms that try to do that. I mean, in some ways, you know, top 40 is all about the hottest tune right now in your community. What would you say is Texas's emblematic music or artist?
You might say Willie Nelson, because he crosses all genres, all generations. Everybody loves Willie. But you have Beyonce. Destiny's Child came on the scene in 1990 out of Houston. And then Beyonce has gone on to sell 118 million albums worldwide. She's one of the biggest stars in the universe.
Beyonce stands alone. You know, album sales plus celebrity, that's a category by itself.
Absolutely.
Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Riley, program director at KUTX in Austin. So it's Beyonce in Texas, or Chris from New Braunfels, Texas, says Willie Nelson. It's rodeo time in Texas as well, Texas.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
From one of you in Statesville, North Carolina, for that state, it's Wagon Wheel. It's been the anthem of North Carolina for years.
Headed down south to the land of the pines. I'm thumbing my way to North Carolina. Staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights.
Looking here in the alley by the light switch, who watches over you?
Heard from Watertown, Mass. They might be giants. These guys tinker with everything old and everything new, and they're natives of Lincoln, Massachusetts. More on The Musical Map coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
Sometimes technology seems to go terribly wrong.
The algorithm's actually quite simple. What I did was I created a top artist for every state based on the online plays and compared it to the online chart for the United States.
That's Paul Amare. He's a software developer at a place called EchoNest. His somewhat joyless but rather intriguing algorithm has produced a musical map of state-to-state online searches that he says shows the definitive musical identity of every U.S. state.
A state like New York, its most popular played artist might be Jay-Z. But if you look at the most popular artist that's played in New York as compared to the rest of the country, it's James Blake, which is quite a bit different than what you'd expect.
Okay, Paul's EchoNest map is kind of a head-scratcher. Intriguing. Feels a bit off, though. Maybe it's sort of like the state bird. Sort of right. Sort of, I guess so. Who can make a case for a state music without relying on an algorithm? We've got three candidates from three different states with three different state birds. John Richards is associate program director and morning show host at KEXP in Seattle, Washington, where the number one pop artist, according to the EchoNest map, is the head and the heart. Joe Silva is an independent producer with WUGA in Athens, Georgia, where the map choice is future. And for Dave Campbell, host of the local show with The Current in St. Paul, Minnesota, where the map says the top artist is metric, an immediate controversy, like the dispute over the state bird. Is it the common loon or the mosquito?
We have two birds here.
Yes.
So I think we're indecisive from the jump. And I don't know. As far as that map goes, metric, it's actually, that makes sense to me that people from Minnesota would buy more metric records than anywhere else.
All the oceans boil, the rivers
play. But there's a whole lot more. I would say one thing that we are enjoying here that maybe people are just about to hear more about would be a rapper named Lizzo.
Time's up. I'm jumping in the side door. Beside Joe, this position knows how my yo. A child yo, to a mountain making miles so. Gemstone, ain't got nothing on my shine. Yo, a bad yo. The rules I make for pothole. Shut it. I done it. Sun it.
Minnesota transplant by way of Detroit, and she lived in Texas for a while. She teamed up with one of the producers from the Doomtree Collective, which is another thing that I would say probably is listened to more here than anywhere else in the country. And the two of them put out this record, and she is just pure and simple dynamite. She is just a force. She sings, she dances, she raps. I saw her play flute in this like 10-piece instrumental juggernaut called Dream Crusher. She just plays with everyone, finds her way to fit in with any type of music or any style of performer. But when she's on stage, you can't peel your eyes away from her.
Let's talk to John Richards, associate program director and morning show host at KEXP in Seattle, Washington. Now, the willow goldfinch is the state bird of Washington, and I don't think I ever saw one when I lived out there. What would you say is the state music of Washington, bearing in mind that people in Seattle are very, very different from the people over on the eastern edge of the state.
You know, I've never seen that bird either. And if I were to have any bird be our official bird, it'd probably be a duck. For me, I grew up on the east side of the state. I live on the west side of the state now. It's so obvious. It's Macklemore and Ryan Lewis without question.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a comma. This is being awesome. What
you know about rocking the wolf on your neck? You have Macklemore here in Seattle, Ryan Lewis from Spokane on the other side of the state. They've been true to their Northwest roots, playing benefits, coming back and playing free shows. And a lot like our world champion Seattle Seahawks, the state sort of adopted Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, not just the city of Seattle. And that's the only artist that jumped out as something you could honestly say everyone in this state is proud of and listens to all the time.
So how do you explain the map coming up with the head and the heart?
Put your dreams away for now. I won't see you for some time. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind. Mama once told me, you're already home where you feel love. I am lost in my mind. I get lost in my mind.
As a morning show host here at KEXP and a resident of Seattle, it's really easy to say head and the heart. I totally agree from my little bubble. Absolutely. No doubt about it. Go down to Ballard with all the beards and go into the bars and you're going to hear a little head and the heart. Those guys are great. They're on local label Sub Pop. Everybody in this city listens to them, from your indie rockers to your, you know, middle-aged dads to probably some grandmas and grandpas too. They're very popular here in Seattle. Now, if you were to ask me outside of Seattle, 20 minutes in any direction, I don't know if that's true or not. I would say it's probably not.
Joe Silva down in Athens, Georgia. That's another sort of music scene that is a bit of an island in the state. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. We are an oasis unto ourselves, for sure.
And the state bird of Georgia, as everyone knows, is the brown thrasher. So a lot of Megadeth and Anthrax there in Georgia.
I think we've sort of dispossessed ourselves of that fact just because I think the hockey team by the same name was so wretched that you know, people are trying to downplay the thrasher.
So how much turbulence is created by the map choosing Future as Georgia's emblematic song?
I mean, you know, when you just look at this map as a whole, it sort of paints the country as, you know, having musical tastes that are about as exciting as a roll of beige wallpaper, you know. I'm sure that there's a fair amount of that being listened to, especially when you talk about down in metro Atlanta. But I think if you're honest about where Georgia is in the post-alternative world, you know, the state is probably split across, you know, sort of a tripartite axis of indie rock, southern rock, and hardcore, you know, hip hop. The bands that draw the largest here in Georgia are bands like the Drive-By Truckers, who are sort of a good old-fashioned southern rock and roll band that can do what I think is fairly uncommon these days, is multi-day residency in the bigger cities here, and draw packed audiences for three nights, four nights in a row.
But you both go to jail for them four little babies you made and delivered along the way.
I just don't think that, you know, the post-college rock Georgia listenership is that easily defined.
Down with the map, man. Stop trying to put me in a box. I hear you, Joe.
Right.
Dave, John, and Joe, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Absolutely welcome.
You bet.
Three public radio musical voices there from Georgia, Washington State, and Minnesota. For most of human history, human life was nasty, brutish, and short. Today, life expectancy has vastly improved, though. There is only one thing we can't escape dying from, that one inescapable disease, aging. What is a human lifespan? 100 years? 120 years? Is there any reason why we can't function biologically and mentally for 200 years? This is a culture and policy question we will be exploring all week. Want to live to 200? What worries you about our society if everyone could? Tell us the story of how you most want to age. Genomic and synthetic life scientist J. Craig Venter says aging is a phenomenon we can control and arrest through genomic science. He believes that by aggressively accelerating the mapping of human genes, we can better understand and prevent the consequences of human aging. Craig Venter's new project with private funding and an association with the University of California, San Diego, is called Human Longevity.
Age is the number one risk factor for every disease, but it's not treated as a disease on its own. We're trying to use layers of information that have never been put together. So starting with the entire human genome, layering in the genetic code of the microbes, we'll be measuring the proteins, we'll be measuring the chemicals, we'll be doing tests that people won't necessarily be able to get anywhere else, and combining that all together. We're trying to get the whole picture and create a database that can actually become really predictive of what's associated with disease, what's associated with health, really trying to put the puzzle together to understand what's predictive, what's not.
And I want to talk about the science in just a moment, but just staying on the sort of philosophical question of, you know, what it means to have a 150-year lifespan or a 200-year lifespan or a non-aging lifespan where you're not concerned after you turn 60 about the kinds of things that I think obsess most people, certainly in the developed world, about when their demise is and what it might consist of. What do you think humans would do with that huge amount of space to think free of the idea that there's this sword of Damocles hanging over their heads, that their body's going to break down and then that's what the next 20 years are going to be like?
Well, that's probably not going to change anytime soon. But, you know, if we live longer and we're healthier, we can have more productive lives. We can solve all the economic problems by simply changing the retirement age to age 75 and still have another 20 or 30 years of healthy life after that.
Why do you think that solves the economic problems rather than tripling the unemployment rate?
Well, because in fact, what we do is we have people that pay in for their, quote, normal careers, and now they're living much longer, withdrawing from the system that was never intended to do that. People have a chance to be productive longer, which is good for them and good for society. Retirement generally isn't good for anybody.
So socially, we weren't prepared for the advances in healthcare that have led to the longevity we're already experiencing.
That's correct.
And being ready for an additional, you know, bonus is certainly hard to imagine.
Well, even if we can live all to what's being predicted into our 90s. My mother's turning 91 this year.
Congratulations.
Mentally, totally intact, but her body's starting to wind down, getting frail. Sarcopenia, you lose your muscle mass or you lose your muscle tone. There's ways, we think, in the future to change that and at least keep people more active for a longer period of time. So, you know, we're not trying to push to get 150 or 200 as a lifespan. We have a lot of other problems on the planet that we have to solve. But healthcare is now the single most expensive rising thing in our economy, that if we go to a preventative medicine paradigm, if we try to prevent diseases instead of waiting to treat them in end stages after they occur, we can lower the healthcare budget. We can have people live a healthier life. For example, Bert Wolgastein, one of the top cancer researchers in the world, has recently talked about how colon cancer is a 30-year disease. And over the first 27 years, if it's treated there, it can be successfully treated. The last 3 years is when it starts to metastasize and gets to be very difficult to treat.
Does your science, your sort of genetic database kind of big data approach allow for distinguishing between positives and false positives in our ability to image? And we can see a lot of things, but we can't necessarily determine its predictive quality at the state of the science right now.
Yeah. Imaging is getting much better and becoming quantitative, and that's going to be an important part of what we're doing. But let me give you an example. My genome's been on the internet now for 14 years. It's well known that I'm heterozygote for APOE4, which gives me an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. I recently underwent the brain scans looking for amyloid in my brain, and there was none. So there appears to be this dichotomy between an increased genetic risk and the actuality, and the same is true for breast cancer, every kind of disease you can imagine. And so I obviously have in my genome protective alleles that are keeping me from getting Alzheimer's disease.
And that's what you need to find.
That's what we're going to be looking for, is the protective part of the genome.
Do you think in this particular initiative the government will jump aboard? And in the regulatory sphere, do you think they'll deliver the proper sort of regulatory environment for your kind of investigation to flourish?
With the FDA, we've already beginning a dialogue with them. I think the FDA is critical for this. Regulating test, I think, is an important thing because there's so many different kinds of tests out there that aren't very meaningful. You know, is the quality of the information you're being given, does it mean anything? Can you do anything with it? And if you're trying to decide to have your breast removed, are you making that decision based on reliable data? This has to work very broadly for the healthcare industry. It has to be financially viable. It has to actually be truly actionable, reduce the cost of medicine if it's going to be highly successful. That can't be done driven by the government.
So finally, Mr. Venter, there are a lot of people who are going to be listening to this. And you've already said, you know, it's a misnomer that you're trying to live forever. And it's a misnomer that this is about immortality. It's about longevity. It's about creating a genomic-based healthcare strategy. Nevertheless, you know, there's a notion out there of people are successful enough. There's a kind of Charles Foster Kane effect that, okay, you make your first billion, the first thing you want to do is like chop off your head and, you know, freeze it so that when, you know, the technology is available, you can live forever, whatever sorts of suggestions. Google's got a live forever initiative going on. Who's to say that the therapies that you're talking about will only be available for people at the very, very highest level of the income level? And for everyone else, this is really going to be a pipe dream.
Right. It's a very fair question. 14 years ago, it cost $100 billion to sequence my genome. Now it's down to $1,000. I think the next decade's going to see it down to $100 or less. It cost almost $1,000 just to get a single gene test for breast cancer right now. So I think it's part of the picture of what does public health cover. I think if we make the case that having your genome sequenced and having this other information can actually help your health outcome, can lower the cost of health care by getting to a preventative medicine, then it will be broadly available.
J. Craig Venter, genomic and synthetic life scientist, co-founder of Human Longevity Incorporated, and I gather a Mother's Day present for your 90-year-old mom that would reduce her aging. That would be a pretty darn good Mother's Day present.
Yeah, she asked me to hurry up.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Do you want to live to 100? How will it change your plans? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. You can also go to Facebook, facebook.com/The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews, now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.